सहना भवतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विभिषावहै ॐ शान्तिः 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 पूर्णमदः पूर्णमिदं पूर्णात् पूर्णमुदच्यते पूर्णस्य पूर्णमादाय पूर्णमेवावशिष्यते ॐ शान्तिः 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 असतो मा सद्गमय तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय मृत्योर्मामृतं गमय सवितुर्वरं रूपं ज्योति परस्य धीमहि यन्नः सत्येन दीपयेत्। Good evening. So tonight we come to the ninth chapter in the Life Divine, The Pure Existent. This saw its publication on the 15th of April in 1915. It opens with a verse from the Chandogya Upanishad. Sri Aurobindo translates it, "One indivisible, that is pure existence." He's early on in the work of the Life Divine, translated it as one without a second. The Sanskrit is asid ekam eva dityam. Asid, one only, or sheer existence. Ekam, one. Eva dityam, without a second. Indivisible. So either way that you render it, the idea is the same. Being cannot be divided. You may also remember that the Chandogya Upanishad, by contrast with some of the others, insists that this universe rises from real being, does not come out of non-being, is not a figment of something that arises out of what does not exist. Because anything that is must come from what is. This is its perspective. So we begin with that in mind, and we'll find many occasions in these coming paragraphs to see just how Sri Aurobindo takes this one concept of an undivided being and spreads it throughout the universe and throughout our experience of it in a way that renders it meaningful to us. So he writes, "When we withdraw our gaze from its egoistic preoccupation with limited and fleeting interests and look upon the world with dispassionate and curious eyes that search only for the truth, our first result is the perception of a boundless energy of infinite existence infinite movement, infinite activity, pouring itself out in limitless space, in eternal time. An existence that surpasses infinitely our ego, or any ego, or any collectivity of egos, in whose balance the grandiose products of eons are but the dust of a moment, and in whose incalculable sum numberless myriads count only as a petty swarm. We instinctively act and feel and weave our life thoughts as if this stupendous world movement were at work around us as center and for our benefit, for our help or harm, or as if the justification of our egoistic cravings, emotions, ideas, standards were its proper business, even as they are our own chief concern. When we begin to see, we perceive that it exists for itself, not for us, has its own gigantic aims, its own complex and boundless idea, its own vast desire or delight that it seeks to fulfill, its own immense and formidable standards, which look down as if with an indulgent and ironic smile at the pettiness of ours. And yet, let us not swing over to the other extreme and form too positive an idea of our own insignificance. That too would be an act of ignorance and the shutting of our eyes to the great facts of the universe. That had to be read at one go. It's too beautiful. It is symphonic. So he opens with this idea that as we gaze out at the universe, what we see first is the expression of sheer energy, limitless movement, endless becoming, infinite apparently in its scope, immeasurable to our ken and to our capacity to gauge. But one thing that is sure is that we think that we're at the center. That the universe is spinning around us and around us. And that is literally the meaning of egocentricity. Ego is the Latin and the Greek word for self. And centricity means it's the center of things. Now, Sri Aurobindo will speak to that, for there is some bit of justice in it. And yet, the universe exists for itself, as he writes, you know. It has its own interests to declaim, its own goals to pursue, and we are a part of it. Not an insignificant part, but we don't stand personally, egoistically, at the center of the whole meaning of this gigantic expression of pure being through energy. So again, as he closes, to balance the nature of self in the universe is his goal, always to harmonize, always to find the proper integration of these various terms of being. Universe and self are not exclusive one of the other. We must see synthetically, but can we with the mind? Back to the universe. For this boundless movement does not regard us as unimportant to it. Science reveals to us how minute is the care, how cunning the device, how intense the absorption it bestows upon the smallest of its works, even as on the largest. This mighty energy is an equal and impartial mother, Samam Brahma, in the great term of the Gita, and its intensity and force of movement is the same in the formation and upholding of a system of suns and the organization of the life of an anthill. The reference to the Gita, by the way, is chapter 5, verse 19. if you like to keep track of that. It is the illusion of size, of quantity, that induces us to look on the one as great, the other as petty. If we look, on the contrary, not at mass of quantity, but force of quantity, we shall say that the ant is greater than the solar system it inhabits, and man greater than all inanimate nature put together. But this again is the illusion of quality. So there's an illusion of quantity and an illusion of quality. Let us not put one foot in one and one foot in the other. When we go behind and examine only the intensity of the movement, of which quality and quantity are aspects, we realize that this Brahman dwells equally in all existences, equally partaken of by all in its being, we are tempted to say, equally distributed to all in its energy. But this, too, is an illusion of quantity. This is a spatial idea, he means to say. Brahman dwells in all, indivisible, yet as if divided and distributed. If we look again with an observing perception not dominated by intellectual concepts, but informed by intuition and culminating in knowledge by identity, we shall see that the consciousness of this infinite energy is other than our mental consciousness, that it is indivisible and gives not an equal part of itself, but its whole self at one and the same time to the solar system and to the anthill. To Brahman, there are no whole and parts, but each thing is all itself and benefits by the whole of Brahman. Quality and quantity differ. The self is equal. Samam Brahma. The form and manner and result of the force of action vary infinitely, but the eternal, primal, infinite energy is the same in all. The force of strength that goes to make the strong man is no whit greater than the force of weakness that goes to make the weak. The energy spent is as great in repression as in expression, in negation as in affirmation, in silence as in sound. So we will get to a shift in terminology, but clearly he's talking about the chit shakti, the conscious power of real being as expressive of this universe, and that in expressing it, that existence is undivided and continues to dwell completely in each thing. And how do we know this? We do not know this by measuring it out with our reason. We cannot logically deduce it. We may come close to forming some simulacrum with a philosophy. But what will take us there, what will reveal this to us, is the power of intuition, going beyond reason. And that power of intuition, remember, intuere, to look within, to penetrate, to go inside, which leads you in that process in which being dwells upon being to the sheer identity, which is the sound ground of knowledge. Real knowledge is captured only by the experience of identity. In other words, when the consciousness has become one with its object of attention, there is knowledge. It is oneness always which rules. So insight leading to identity is what gives knowledge. To resume with this paragraph, quality and quantity differ. The self is equal. The form and manner and result of the force of action vary infinitely, but the eternal, primal, infinite energy is the same in all, as we've read, but we reinforce. The force of strength that goes to make the strong man is no whit greater than the force of weakness that goes to make the weak. A wonderful bit of humor that he's blended into philosophy. The energy spent is as great in repression as in expression, in negation as in affirmation, in silence as in sound. Therefore, the first reckoning we have to mend is that between this infinite movement, this energy of existence, which is the world and ourselves. At present, we keep a false account. We are infinitely important to the all. But to us, the all is negligible. We alone are important to ourselves. This is grown in stark contrast as we've seen human appetite grow and divorce itself from the welfare of the world and become a threat actually to global life. Sri Aurobindo writes, "This is the sign of the original ignorance, which is the root of the ego, that it can only think with itself as center, as if it were the all, and of that which is not itself, accepts only so much as it is mentally disposed to acknowledge, or as it is forced to recognize by the shocks of its environment. Even when it begins to philosophize, does it not assert that the world only exists in and by its consciousness?" Of course, this is the idealistic philosophy of Berkeley, George Berkeley. It also exists in the East in Yogacara idealism, in Buddhism, etc. Its own state of consciousness or mental standards are to it the test of reality. All outside its orbit or view tends to become false or non-existent. This mental self-sufficiency of man creates a system of false accountantship which prevents us from drawing the right and full value from life. There is a sense in which these pretensions of the human mind and ego repose on a truth, but this truth only emerges when the mind has learned its ignorance and the ego has submitted to the all and lost in it its separate self-assertion. To recognize that we, or rather, the results and appearances we call ourselves are only a partial movement of this infinite movement, and that it is that infinite which we have to know, to be consciously and to fulfill faithfully, is the commencement of true living. So we must become that, we must resume that. And then we are really alive. Until then, we are only partially ourselves, and we are stunted in our growth within the cosmos. And the cosmos, expecting our development, leaning upon us for its own deliverance, cannot grow. We are the key to cosmic growth. To recognize that in our true selves, we are one with the total movement and not minor or subordinate, is the other side of the account, and its expression in the manner of our being, thought, emotion, and action is necessary to the culmination of a true or divine living. So, enough of the rational life. Now we must become endued in our spiritual being and live from the center of our real self, not from the ego which thinks itself to be the center, But when we find in ourself what we really are, then we are one with Brahman, and necessarily one with all being. So, to continue. And I'm presuming his language is patent, is clear. But to settle the account, we have to know, what is this all, this infinite and omnipotent energy? So what is the nature of this chit-shakti? And here we come to a fresh complication. For it is asserted to us by the pure reason, and it seems to be asserted to us by Vedanta, that as we are subordinate and an aspect of this movement, so the movement is subordinate and an aspect of something other than itself, of a great timeless, spaceless stability, sthanu, which is immutable, inexhaustible, and unexpended, not acting, though containing all this action, not energy, but pure existence. So, if we are a figuring in our apparent being in this gigantic universal becoming, this universal becoming is itself an expression of something which remains unexpressed. What is that? That sthanu, that thing that does not move. Energy, he suggests, is subordinate to existence. So let's go back in our minds and remember how he has pinned his whole philosophy on the experience of Sat-Chit-Ananda, sheer existence, sheer consciousness, sheer delight, a triunity. They are not separate. But in terms of the manifestation of the universe, existence is the ground. Consciousness is the conscious force which gives it its propulsion. Existence is the base. Consciousness renders it mobile, active, forms the myriads out of the oneness. And so he asserts pure existence. Those who see this, those who see only this world energy can declare indeed that there is no such thing. Our idea of an eternal stability, an immutable pure existence, is a fiction of our intellectual conceptions, starting from a false idea of the stable. For there is nothing that is stable. All is movement, and our conception of the stable is only an artifice of our mental consciousness by which we secure a standpoint for dealing practically with the movement. So if you simply take your stand in the midst of the becoming and say, this is the nature of your experience, this is all you can know, all of this is ever in motion, then you can resile to the early philosophy of Heraclitus in the West and of Buddha in the East, that all this is passing. That in Heraclitus' world, you cannot step into the same river twice, because always there are new waters flowing on and flowing on. You yourself have changed by the time you go back to step in again. You're not the same person, really. And there is a justice in that perspective. Well, let us continue. We'll see where this leads us. It is easy to show that this is true in the movement itself. There is nothing there that is stable. All that appears to be stationary is only a block of movement, a formulation of energy at work, which so affects our consciousness that it seems to be still. Somewhat as the earth seems to us to be still, somewhat as a train in which we are traveling seems to be still in the midst of a rushing landscape. But is it equally true that underlying this movement, supporting it, there is nothing that is moveless and immutable? Is it true that true, pardon me, is it true that existence consists only in the action of energy? Or is it not rather that energy is an output of existence? The way he phrases the sentence tells you what he thinks. We see at once that if such an existence is, it must be, like the energy, infinite. Neither reason nor experience, nor intuition nor imagination bears witness to us of the possibility of a final terminus. All end and beginning presuppose something beyond the end or beginning. An absolute end, an absolute beginning, is not only a contradiction in terms, but a contradiction of the essence of things, of violence, of fiction. Infinity imposes itself upon the appearances of the finite by its ineffugable self-existence. I am going to make a wager that that is a new word to you. Ineffugable means inescapable. It is a word that Sri Aurobindo invented. And if you'll allow me a diversion, he writes, quote, "It is a new word, like dynamis, introduced into the English language by Sri Aurobindo." Yes, he's writing in the third person. "It means inescapable, inevitable, not to be avoided," end quote. And here's another quote. Ineffugible is the correct formation, but it has no force or power of suggestive sound in it. The A in ineffugable has been brought by illegitimate analogy from words like fugacious, Latin fugare, because it sounds better and is forcible. End quote. So he liked the way ineffable sounded because it's a hard G and gives it power, as opposed to the soft G in ineffugible. But it means inescapable. Infinity imposes itself upon the appearances of the finite by its inescapable self-existence. In other words, it is, and all becoming expresses it. But this is infinity with regard to time and space, an eternal duration, interminable extension. The pure reason goes farther, and looking in its own colorless and austere light at time and space, points out that these two are categories of our consciousness, conditions under which we arrange our perception of phenomenon. This is a rational game. In other words, this is the way that we stage the universe to ourselves. We build a simulacrum, we build a replica of the universe with this modeling and call this part space and that part time. And these are expressions of our experience which are thrown into rational form. When we look at existence in itself, time and space disappear. If there is any extension, it is not spatial, but a psychological extension. If there is any duration, it is not a temporal, but a psychological duration. And it is then easy to see that this extension and duration are only symbols which represent to the mind something not translatable into intellectual terms, an eternity which seems to us the same all-containing, ever-new moment. An infinity, which seems to us the same all-containing, all-pervading point without magnitude. the most important part of the sentence is when we look at existence in itself. This is a referral to the deep experience of reality, which we get through the insight of consciousness penetrating object, of intuition becoming knowledge by identity. So in other words, this is a yogic knowledge. Yoga, that which links us to the other, yokes the two. And this conflict of terms, so violent, yet accurately expressive of something we do perceive, shows that mind and speech have passed beyond their natural limits and are striving to express a reality in which their own conventions and necessary oppositions disappear into an ineffable identity. Mind and speech passing beyond their limits. Mind falls back from that unattaining. Taittiriya Upanishad again. And all is reconciled into an identity of being which cannot be spoken. The tongue cannot give words sufficient to express it. Our palate cannot paint it. Our mathematics cannot measure it. That simply is beyond all manifestation. We can experience it and become one with it, but we cannot convert it into an object of knowledge. Because even in the expression of the universe, it eludes with its transcendence the ken of our mind. But is this a true record, he writes? May it not be that time and space so disappear merely because the existence we are regarding is a fiction of the intellect, a fantastic nihil created by speech, which we strive to erect into a conceptual reality. We regard again that existence in itself, and we say no. So Sri Aurobindo rejects the idea that a non-being precedes being. He is in line with Parmenides and with the Chandogya Upanishad, Parmenides saying that being is, non-being is not. There is something behind the phenomenon, not only infinite but indefinable. Of no phenomenon, of no totality of phenomena, can we say that absolutely it is. So whether we're looking at a particular piece of the world stream, or if we look at all of it aggregated, collected together, we still cannot define it. We still cannot say that it absolutely is, because this is part of the play of becoming. Absolutely, to say it is absolute, means that it is beyond time, beyond space. That is not the nature of our sensorial experience. That's not the nature of this universe. This will take us someplace. Bear with him. Be patient. The very conception of movement carries with it the potentiality of repose and betrays itself as an activity of some existence. The very idea of energy in action carries with it the idea of energy abstaining from action. And an absolute energy not in action is simply and purely absolute existence. So chit, consciousness, resolves into sat, existence. The possibility that a universe can be quiet within itself. Well, what is the nature of the unmanifested universe before the Big Bang? We can't say. We can say that it's not manifested. then suddenly it moves, it comes into being and expresses itself. And we're agog with the wonder of the universe. But it rested in something first. And what it rests in, when it's not active, is in pure being. Absolute existence. We have only these two alternatives, either an indefinable pure existence or an indefinable energy in action. And if the latter alone is true, without any stable base or cause, then the energy is a result and phenomenon generated by the action, the movement which alone is. In other words, does the becoming give rise to the becoming? Without reference back to being. We have then, he writes, no existence, or we have the nihil of the Buddhists with existence as only an attribute of an eternal phenomenon, of action, of karma, of movement. So we have the shunya, the void. This, asserts the pure reason, leaves my perceptions unsatisfied, contradicts my fundamental seeing, and therefore cannot be. So, philosophically, Sri Aurobindo says, he will not accept it. Experientially, it contradicts this fundamental knowledge by identity, which is the nature of his intuition that led at its root to the experience of Brahman behind the world. So it would contradict the yogic experience, which is the beginning of his philosophy of life divine. So this he will not give up. So he rejects, in other words, what he regards as an implausible argument from the experience of the Buddhist. And he continues, for it brings us to a last, abruptly seizing stair of an ascent which leaves the whole staircase without support, suspended in the void. Exactly. He will not accept that the shunya is the basis of the universe. Now, just to recapitulate, earlier, when he looked at the Taittiriya Upanishad, which said from non-being comes being, he interpreted that non-being as the transcendent, which remains aloof even from that which it positively expresses. Even as it expresses pure being, and that being expresses the universe as a becoming in time and space, there is that which remains uninvolved even so. It is utterly free even of that. And in that sense, it is not being. That is the only way that Sri Aurobindo will accept it. But it is an unknowable, then. It is an indefinable reality. But to say that it is not is to play with words. He will not accept that. Now, it is a little interesting to see Sri Aurobindo published this in April 1915. He would have written it in the middle of March 1915. That's a few weeks after Paul and Mira Richard have left India to go back to France. And as I mentioned before, I think, Paul Richard was argumentative. He was, in his own mind, a philosopher of considerable weight. And he liked to take a posture that the universe was an expression of will, if of anything. And he liked some of the philosophic underpinnings of Buddhism. So you can see in the early chapters of The Life Divine, Sri Aurobindo is trying to take a position with Buddhism which interprets it in a large Vedantic sense. But when you are pushed into a corner, then you must make a choice. And so here, Sri Aurobindo is firmly placing himself on the side that there is a sheer existence of which this universe is an expression, and it is an expression of the conscious being of that sheer existence, that they are not devoid of the other. Existence is conscious, consciousness is real. And why would the existence of consciousness want to present itself in a manifold world? For the play, for the delight. Because there is joy in it. So, let me see. Have we a little more time? Can we do another paragraph with you, by your leave? If this indefinable, infinite, timeless, spaceless existence is, it is necessarily a pure absolute. It cannot be summed up in any quantity or quantities. It cannot be composed of any quality or combination of qualities. It is not an aggregate of forms or a formal substratum of forms. In all forms, quantities, qualities, if all forms, quantities, qualities were to disappear, this would remain. Existence without quantity, without quality, without form, is not only conceivable, but it is the one thing we can conceive behind these phenomena. So let's pause for a moment. It cannot be summed up in any quantity or quantities, so it is undivided. It is not an aggregate of forms. It is a oneness. It is the one thing we can conceive behind these phenomena. It is soul, one. And what did the chapter begin with? One indivisible, that is pure existence. He is giving great, powerful exposition to this leading concept of the Vedanta, as expressed in the Chandogya Upanishad here, that all this manifest universe and we in it are the expression of this real, of this conscious being. Asid ekam eva dityam, one only without a second, one indivisible that is pure existence. Necessarily, when we say it is without them, we mean that it exceeds them, that it is something into which they pass in such a way as to cease to be what we call form, quality, quantity, and out of which they emerge as form, quality, and quantity in the movement. They do not pass away into one form, one quality, one quantity, which is the basis of all the rest, for there is none such, but into something which cannot be defined by any of these terms. So, all things that are conditions and appearances of the movement pass into that from which they have come, and there, so far as they exist, become something that can no longer be described by the terms that are appropriate to them in the movement. Look at this. They pass into that from which they have come. This is the Taittiriya Upanishad. Remember, he began a chapter with this, the story about Bhrigu. What is that reality from which all things come? First, we think it is matter. All things come from matter. In matter, all things are sustained. Into matter, all things pass. And then life, and then mind, and then the supermind, and finally into bliss itself. The Taittiriya leads us. The movement that passes into that from which they have come, all these things. So he never strays away from his Vedantic basis, does he? Therefore, we say that the pure existence is an absolute, and in itself unknowable by our thought, although we can go back to it in a supreme identity that transcends the terms of knowledge. The movement, on the contrary, is the field of the relative. And yet, by the very definition of the relative, all things in the movement contain, are contained in, and are the absolute. The relation of the phenomena of nature to the fundamental ether which is contained in them, constitutes them, contains them, and yet is so different from them that entering into it they cease to be what they now are, is the illustration given by the Vedanta as most nearly representing this identity and difference between the absolute and the relative. Bhagavad Gita, chapter 9, verse 5, verse 6. This goes back to that idea that reality is impartite, cannot be divided, is fully there in all things. The Brahman is as much fully represented in that lamp as the center of the universe, if you will, as this whole vast cosmos is. Brahman is completely there. The ant that we stepped on coming into the center was as complete an expression of Brahman, was absolute Brahman. One more paragraph. Necessarily, when we speak of things passing into that from which they have come, we are using the language of our temporal consciousness and must guard ourselves against its illusions. The emergence of the movement from the immutable is an eternal phenomenon, and it is only because we cannot conceive it in that beginningless, endless, ever-new moment, which is the eternity of the timeless, that our notions and perceptions are compelled to place it in a temporal eternity of successive duration, to which are attached the ideas of an always recurrent beginning, middle, and end. So, to us, the only thing that we understand is the beginning of the story, the middle of the story, the end of the story. That does not capture the essence of what is eternal being behind the becoming, and how creation arises from it, how it persists, and into what it subsides. We'll have to take up in subsequent meetings. Yes. So we will put our bookmark there, and we'll complete the chapter next time. But I want to mention that the next time that we meet to study the Life Divine will not be next week. We have dear friends who've been part of our yogic family for over 30 years who live in Tampa and who have asked if I could be present for an important ceremony. Kiran and Lekha Senapati have a daughter named Gitanjali who is an attorney down there, and she is to wed, and they would like me to come and be party to an important event. So unfortunately that will make it impossible for me to be with you at this hour next Sunday. So what I propose is that we'll take the balance of this chapter up on Sunday the 21st. And in the middle of the week, I'll send some readings to you from Mother and Sri Aurobindo, which are relevant to this material. And then on Sunday night, you can take turns and read from this material and discuss among yourselves, and then have lots of questions with which you can batter me when I come back. And unfortunately, our friends with us on Zoom won't be a party to that, but in a sense they'll have a reprieve from having listened to me for a week, so they get their own blessing in a way. So I'll carry your happy regards from around the country and from Pensacola to our friends in Tampa, and I'll bring theirs back to you. So, any brief questions this evening before we go for meditation? Very good. Then, the best is yet to come in this chapter. Something to look forward to. And when we meet, the 21st, that's going to be near the winter solstice. I'm not sure if it actually falls on that date or not, but it'll be close. The return of light, the pure existent, I think that's a wonderful marriage. The pure existent, pure white. That is what the word Shiva actually means. Shiva means pure white. What is auspicious because it is that. And that is the image in a name of pure being. So you can carry that with you into meditation. So namaste, Jai Ma. And good night to my Zoom friends.
Good night.
Good night.